Welcome to the CEN Show, the voice of the world community. There are numerous internet shows that people can access. How many of these platforms are in place to help improve the world's condition? Well, this show and the podcast Conscience Corner with Professor Amir Ra and historian Joe Hemrick are on most Mondays and Wednesdays, featuring world community act personalities of purpose of improving the world's condition. We have 192 shows on YouTube and more than that on the website Community Education Network. And I'm about to show that. Let me show that website. It's our website and we're proud of it. Let me go back to the internet because I had something else up. So now let me share this. Give me a second here. All right, here it is. That's the website, Community Education Network. And this is the home page, as you can see. This is how you access both of the podcasts. And here are the different pages. And visit. You should enjoy it and join the forum. Got to get people writing in the forum there. Okay. I am your host, Rasaki Mascani. I would like to introduce the panel. We have Sister Make It Happen. She's one of our group members. We have Brother Doctor, historian Joe Hembrick, Linda Shorter, and Brother Mashinda, and Professor Amin Ra. Now we used to have a Fab Five. Now we got a Sensational Seven. Okay. So that's our panel for this evening. And then I'm going to introduce the guests. Tonight's guest is Aisha Blanchard Young, and I will interview her this evening. I met Ms. Young about a month ago in a meeting. She was speaking about racial information and moved me to address the gathering, and I immediately met her and invited her to be a guest on the show, and the rest, as they say, is history. Good evening, Ms. Young. How are you? And please tell us some things about yourself.
Hi, good evening, everyone. Thanks for inviting me. I am a mom of two beautiful Black boys who are in middle school and a seventh grader and a high school student who's a 10th grader. And they are pretty much why I do this work. I dream of a world where they can wake up and go to school, wake up in the morning and be excited to go to school. And when they get to school, they feel loved at school in more than one place, you know? And so as an educator, my background is in education. I was a teacher for about 16 years. I taught in Englewood Unified K-12, kindergarten, middle school, high school, history, government, all of those in the alternative school. So I got to work with some of our most vulnerable students. And I got to work with students when they're just beginning and have this joy about learning in kindergarten and then all the stuff in between. And I'm a Southern, even though I'm born here, I'm raised in a Southern household. My parents are from the deep, deep South, small towns. One's called the Village of Grove State. My mom from Maringouin, off Highway 77 in the 10, Interstate 10. And so I just have also feel like I have a deep connection to my Southern culture and family. I'm just one generation. I'm the first child born with like all of my rights. And I carry that with me all the time. So my vision for my students and I mean, for my kids and the obligation, responsibility I know I have standing on the shoulders of like my grandparents and stuff. Is what like motivates me and keeps me going. I'm also married. I have a husband. I've been married for 17 years. We live in Pomona with our family and my mom. My dad recently passed, so rest in peace, Sam Blanchard. And just, you know, thank you all for inviting me and allowing me to be in this space with other folks who care about our people and our community.
Excellent. So can you tell us what you're doing now with the California Teachers Association?
Yeah, I work with California Teachers Association currently as a human rights my title is human rights consultant, but I call myself a strategist for advancing racial and social justice. And I play multiple roles. I work with in this area region of LA County and Ventura County. So I work in supporting local unions and teacher associations who are, you know, trying to be anti-racist in their union approach, which means that they are, you know, looking at the inequities that exist in the district, trying to use their privilege as a union to center some of those needs and working with the community in that kind of way to lift up our shared interests, because we all have similar interests, like dreams for our students and hopes for what, you know, for our kids to just have like decent life. But I don't think we as our unions have good practice of like deepening partnerships and valuing those relationships. So I get to help and work with chapters in that capacity. I also do facilitation and workshops or educational experiences, I like to call them, that help hold space for change or for transformation around racial and social justice issues. So maybe white supremacy culture and helping folks use windows and mirrors, you know, look in the ways we internalize that and cause harm, but also in the ways that institutionally and systemically those characteristics show up and can cause harm. I also get to work with several programs that we have within California Teacher Association. So there's an Equity Human Rights Conference, and I'm the coordinator, the point on that conference, where we try to hold space for educators that are passionate about social and racial and social justice. Educate, empower, inspire, love, dream, struggle in those spaces, because we know that's how people grow. So I try to lead and facilitate that. And I also, in this role, just work on currently on community schools. It's a statewide movement at transformational schools that operate from bottom up. And there is a historic funding this year for that, about $4 billion that came to that the state said they wanted to invest in community schools. So that's one of my main projects too, is working with chapters who received these grants or who applied for the grants. Compton's one of them. And just trying to help the chapters position themselves to have a seat at the table. And sometimes we have to fight for a seat at the table. Sometimes, most of the time we do, because the power doesn't want to like share it. Those in power, they don't want to share it. I help with organizing efforts like that as well. So I provide, because that's what I did in my previous role here. I've been in the Human Rights Department for 2 years now. And before that, I worked in the CTA, but I worked in Orange County in the Region 4. And I worked with about 10 locals there. And I was chief negotiator, represent, you know, advocacy issues. Maybe there's organizing issues there, bargaining, negotiations, things like that. So I did that when I first started at CTA. And then, you know, prior to that, I worked at United Teachers of Los Angeles for a couple of years. And I was part of that strike mobilization and organizing for that. The schools our students deserve. And we, that was our historic win of community schools actually in the state. And so that's kind of the different roles I play in my role as in CTA. in the human rights department. I just have these other experiences that I'm able to like bring because I started off as just like a baby organizer as a teacher, just like, I think we can make change together. Let's try it, you know, and learning from lots of mentors and folks who also had that belief and took me under their wings.
Wow, that's a real rich history there. And seem like you got a lot of good things going. I like your background there. Okay, so I saw that you taught kindergarten.
Yes.
Did you teach any other grade?
Yeah, I taught kindergarten, then I taught middle school after that. So I taught kindergarten about like 9 years. And then I moved to the middle school where my kindergartners go to. It was time for me to make a change. So I taught middle school English language learners. So I taught English to students at varied levels, some immigrant students that just arrived. And then there's some students who have been learning English for several years. And so I had leveled classes there. But I was only at the middle school a little while because they had to reduce the force there. I volunteered to lead because I was also new there. So I ended up being transferred to a continuation high school. Hillcrest was the name of the school at the time. It's in Inglewood. And I got to like get secondary experience because in a continuation school or alternative school, they'll pretty much take you if you're breathing and you have a credential. and I, at the time, was being active in my union in Inglewood, because I'm about like trying to make the change. I am about trying to be a part of the change and the vision that we're trying to work towards that. And so I got to teach at the secondary school, which I actually have an elementary credential. So that was like, to me, a great opportunity to actually work with secondary students and secondary educators. And they're our most marginalized students. They're the ones like the safety net. So I really was excited to be able to do that, get that opportunity, because I wouldn't have been able to teach secondary otherwise. And that allowed me to use my my bachelor upbringing, my bachelor's, right? My college education, because I majored in political science. So I had a lot of, and I love history. So I taught history, government, AP, World Civ, economics, but also minored in African-American studies as well. So I would like that lens to help our students have more like comprehensive understanding of history, the old narratives. And so that was really a cool experience. So, yeah. And then actually I left Inglewood after about 16 years. And then I went to work in Santa Monica and I got a third grade job, which I'd never taught before. And so I actually have taught third grade too. I taught that for about 2-3 years. And then after that is when I went into professional, I guess you call it professional organizing or staff work. And that's when I went to work for United Teachers of Los Angeles as an organizer.
Okay, so basically you taught on all levels.
Yeah.
K through 12.
Yep. And actually higher ed. I forget to mention that I was also an adjunct professor of faculty at Mount St. Mary's College in their education department, mostly through my during my teaching career, and maybe a year or two into my work in staff work, I still maintain that role there. So I got to work at the higher ed with students who are pursuing their credential, and there I also got to teach students like a different lens for how into the profession that they were entering. Try to provide them with like a critical pedagogies approach so that we can empower our students and think about their agency and see them as our future, not just like, you know, banks that we're just depositing information in. It was very liberating, I guess you could say. So I did get to do that for probably about like 10 years of my teaching life. I was also in that role too. So that was helpful. Just knowing like the different challenges, being able to bring that kind of experience or experience and understanding so that teachers would stay in the profession. because, you know, we all go into teaching, many of us go into teaching. I went into teaching having my own experience and being raised by parents in the South who were like, you got to get your education. Education is the way. And I believe that, subscribe to that. And then when I started teaching, I learned more about the ways that, that our schools actually help perpetuate and maintain some of the oppressive conditions that we live in. And that was very jarring to me because I had an ideal about schooling, you know, and I got to see some other perspectives. And then that just gave me like more conviction around the power of education, but actually approaching it in ways that see the strengths that we bring and trying to build on that, as opposed to seeing it as I have all the knowledge that they, you know, we all have knowledge together and can learn together. So,
right. A gumbo. Okay. I read this article that you were featured in, and it spoke about the meaningful relationships that you build with students and parents. And I think Brother Hembry can appreciate this. So why do you think that's important for educators to adopt that tactic of building those relationships, not only with the students, but the parents also?
Yeah. Well, parents are like our first teachers, for one, and they are who, you know, or our caregivers who we live with are like our first teachers. And when I was teaching kindergarten, we noticed that there was a problem happening. We had 32 students in the class, and I say we because I team taught with a teaching partner. Her name is Miss Bingener. And we saw a problem. Every year we would have several students that needed to be retained, right? And we're like, this is kindergarten. Should kids really be retained in kindergarten? And so then we were taking these courses around critical pedagogy, and we were learning from folks like Pedro Nogueira. We were learning about Paulo Freire. And so we were developing our own pedagogy, our own critical pedagogy, and our own like personal approach. So like we're working in these spaces. We were working in kindergarten, and we're like, we want to just like invite parents for a workshop so we could help them make some flashcards so that we could try to get ahead and prevent these retentions that happen. And then, you know, we might have like 3 or 4 kids at the end of the year that despite efforts and all of that, we still would end up with that. And so we wanted to address that. So we thought, well, like if we could start building with parents and maybe help skill them up a bit to be able to help their kids at home, that might help. And we were in Englewood at the time. The demographics were about half and half, African-American and Latino students. And it's shifted a lot over the years that I was there, 8 years. It went from like half and half to maybe like, you know, 0.23% that were in our classes. So that did shift. But when we started it, that's what was our intent. We're like, we're just going to give them some make it and take it. And we'll do some make it and take it. And so we asked the question, our first meeting, I'll never forget, we asked the question, what dreams do you have for your child? Or what are the dreams you have for your child? And the things that people shared were so moving and just beyond what we thought. You know, we're stuck in the No Child Left Behind era. It's all about testing and, you know, scores and me, myself going through school, my parents being like, you gotta get good grades and all of that. So I just, maybe I expected parents to say that. And when we asked them, they shared things like, I just want my child to be happy when they grow up. You know, I want them to like be proud of themselves. I want them to be able to do things that they really enjoy doing. Like none of the things that they said about their hopes and dreams for their kid was like, I want them to have better test scores or I want them to have better grades. And it was in that moment that I think both my colleague and I both were like moved, and it just like shifted the whole way we began and started seeing our families and our students. We recognize like the ways in which we have internalized characteristics of privilege, if you will, you know, in our role as being educated, getting degrees. In some ways, we were a little judgy about, you know, parents, if the kids didn't come to school dressed right or whatever, we were making all kinds of assumptions. And what this space really showed for us was it just brought the humanity of all of us in the room. We have the same hopes and dreams for their kids as they have for themselves. And honestly, after we started having these meetings, we would have them monthly. You know, families, they would bring food. So we'd like kind of have a potluck. We didn't have any, we only had support in the sense that we could meet and stay after school and we didn't get trouble or kicked out. But we didn't have any fiscal, like financial support. My colleague and I asked our room partner, can we use your room for childcare? And so she'd go on and lead a section while I would be in the room watching the kids. And this might be illegal now, but just kidding. And I would watch the kids. They have a video and that sort of thing. And then when it was my turn, we would switch. And eventually it was so successful. We had make it and take it. We asked parents what it was that they needed. Instead of us determining what they needed or us deciding or thinking we knew, we actually started asking them, like, what would you need to like feel better support to support your child better? What's coming home that you feel like you're struggling with? What could we collectively help each other with? And after that first year, we didn't have a retention. We didn't have to retain any students. And every year after that, we didn't have any retention. And so our goal was to, we're like, can we get this a spread to our kindergarten class? You know, can we get our other colleagues to do it? Because it required volunteering, staying after school, you know, working outside your contract and all those things. But the bang that we got out of it was like our students love learning and we built these family connections that were just amazing. From that experience, I just like saw the power of like parents feeling empowered, feeling like they had something to contribute, that like that alone, like helped empower our students. And then I went on to another school in Inglewood called Bennett Q and worked with some of my colleagues who are really passionate about this, about parent voice and working together with our parents for our students' good. And we all got together and wrote a grant to start a parent university. And we approached that with a very strength-based approach. We're like, parents have something to add and contribute. So we are going to design like a six module university based on what parents said they need. And so we literally intentionally listened to 80% of our parents. Sometimes we're standing outside, sometimes it was calls, and really tried to do like a needs assessment. What are parents saying that they need at the school? What is it that they want? What do they love about our school? What do they not like about our school? And then we, through those conversations, we identified parents to join us on this like parent university organizing team, I guess you could say. And we co-planned the six modules with the parents based on what their needs were. And they co-led and co-facilitated the workshops with us. And we would have 50, 60, 70 parents come because they were topics that they asked for. You know, they want to help with like behavior issues and mental health support. So we had like a psychologist come and be a guest speaker and kind of help them understand what was going on, brain development, what was going on with their brain and all of those kind of things. And it was awesome. They wanted to do some make it, take it around English and language arts and math. They wanted to know how to navigate the school board and be able to advocate for the things that they said they wanted. So we were able to have like guests, our friends on the school board come and share some of those pieces, but also like as a union, we were able to share how to help them navigate through some of that. So every space that I've ever since that kindergarten experience, I've only seen and felt really good results and impacts from like including parents and seeing them as partners who have information, knowledge, experience, wisdom to contribute. And the impacts of that has me believing and continue to work on this and trying to build bridges and open up doors and sharing power with families for the good of our, you know, kids and students.
That's excellent, innovative, and that's what we need. We need people like you that's developing programs with the making those connections with the students and the parents. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah,
I like that. Okay, so what I'm gonna do? I had five questions, but I'm gonna go to the panel because we have some people that can't stay that long, especially Linda. So Linda, we're going to start with you. She's back on the East Coast there. Linda?
Hi, Linda.
Linda, are you there? Okay, we'll come back.
I'm here. I'm just trying to get my mic working.
Okay, Linda. You Linda?
Yes, it's going in and out, but I finally got it right.
Okay, so you have a question or comment for Ms. Zakiya? Ms. Aisha Zakiya?
Zakiya, my question is, in the beginning you talked about a community school. Is that the same as a charter school?
No.
Because I'm not familiar with what a community school is.
Yeah. No. Yeah, community schools, it's a model that's based on these four pillars that guide a community school. The four pillars, sort of like the foundation of it, they are shared decision-making of all stakeholders, extended learning opportunities, and extended learning opportunities for students, wraparound services and mental health support, or just wraparound services and partnerships with community partnerships. And then the fourth pillar is based on deep stakeholder engagement and valuing parent family partnerships. And so community schools actually have been around for like decades, and they exist in a lot of other countries. And in California in 2018, UTL, United Teachers Los Angeles, that was one of the demands, and what they went on strike for were to win this community school model that says you actually are going to build your schools in that schools are the center of our community, and that they should be a hub for what those community needs are. And that too often our schools are designed from a top down or from a deficit mindset. And too often our schools are funded with programs that have zero connection to students. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. We don't have data to support why we're doing X, Y, or Z. So community schools has a different approach. It's about distributing leadership, distributing decision-making, trusting the strengths that the community partners, parents, students, the workers there, meaning the teachers, the classified, the office manager, administrator, it's centering their voices and their expertise and creating structures that's like an addiction to problem solving. So they really take a deep dive and look at root causes of things. Because currently when we deal with problems in education, we just kind of throw a program at it, right? We don't really look at root cause. So we, kids have attendance issues and we're like, oh, let's buy a new app to track the attendance and then punish them when they don't come. As opposed to looking at what's the root cause of the attendance problems. We don't know because we don't ask, like, what's the problem coming to school? And then you find out, well, they are also like taking care of the kids while parents working like three jobs. Or, in one city, we found out it was because of the streetlights, like during daylight savings, it got too dark. And so parents just were having the kids come to school late once there was more light. It had nothing to do. So there's no program or app that would have solved it. And so the beauty of community schools is that it centers the voices of those most impacted by that school, listens, does a needs assessment. And then they build teams within the school of educators, students, parents, community partners that look at what those needs are. They prioritize them and then they implement them and they see, did that work? So they actually use the theory of change, apply the theory of change. Which is something that we don't do enough those in power don't do enough of in education, where we actually like say, okay, we implemented this. Let's test it out. Did it work? How do we know it worked? What measurements did we use? Okay, we'll keep doing this. Or maybe this isn't the right thing to address the problem. And so that's what community schools really tries. The model that we're pushing for is this transformational model, because we also know that when you empower folks who are typically living on the margins, who rarely feel they have a voice to make change, and you actually invite them to the table, and then their ideas get lifted, and then you actually implement something that they suggested, and it worked, that is transformational for us as for folks who, you know, often aren't in those power positions. So just the idea, just being able to empower all of us, the stakeholders, is a very unique piece, and empowering piece of what like this a community school approach brings, that's very different from our traditional school model. A charter school or a public school can approach this model. Any school could approach it, because community schools are, it's a destination. Yes. Like, you might decide some community schools have like a laundromat on campus because that was something that the community needed. They needed like a wash, just a access to a machine so the kids could come to school and not miss school because they didn't have clean clothes. So that might be something that happens. So it is a physical building, and it may have services that are there to support the community based on the needs. But it's also a noun. It's also like a way of being that's different from our traditional school model. It's actually like listening to the students, parents, community partners, educators who are experts about what their kids need, know what students need, know what curriculum needs we have, know that we don't need to overset and overtest students and things like that. And it allows those voices to be lifted, and then building program practices at the school that are really centered around that, that are focusing on improving the whole child. So it could be a charter or a public school that decides we're going to take a community schools approach. It's not for any structure. It's really an approach, a way of being in school, and also a way to a school can exist.
You know, that's excellent. Because I know that when I was, you know, I went and got my administrative credential.
Yeah.
And I always look at, you know, what is the need of our clientele? You know, like you said, they just throw stuff at us. And that's our kids need specific things. And so that approach is excellent. I want to ask Professor Rock, is your son, did he have like a community schools type of situation that he had at the school he had? You are on mute, Professor Rock.
With the community and with various agencies like the Clippers and like fitness gym. They built a gym on his floor, campus. They built a basketball floor and gym, the Clippers did. He worked with rap stars and a lot. The schools are in the community, most public schools. So you pass the community going to work or going to class, and you come out, and sometimes they're in the neighborhood, sometimes they're in business district, or at least part of them are facing a business district or main thoroughfare. So, you know, it depends on the leader of the school as far as their outreach and as far as their vision and as far as their priority. And it depends on the administrators on allowing that teacher to be innovative. And it depends on the school board that hires the superintendent that can work with his administrators, assistants, and district administrators, and buy into some of the things that Aisha is talking about. It's very hard when people focus on tests only. And that's the basis for teachers getting higher pay or schools getting grants and recognition and stability for the administrators of a certain school district. They have to change them because there's just no productivity. But yeah, reaching out to the community is for security. They can help you with your security. Look out for the kids on the way to school and out. And parents can open their doors and step out and watch before school start and after school end, especially seniors and those. We used to hire parents to be safety monitors and bathroom monitors on campuses to involve community relationships and community involvement. So yeah, I mean, I don't know how you function without being community involved as a person. But then you got schools, the teachers beat the kids home, you know. They just come, they go strictly by their book, you know. They don't want to stay after school. They don't start no student organization. It's all about the check and get on out of there. And some of them are intimidated, scared. Some of them have a second job. Some of them have different issues that maybe having domestic issues at home, family. They just don't get involved in the school. You know, you have to deal with why teachers aren't doing things as well as what they should be doing. Just like you look at a student, and say, well, you know, as you just said, Rashiki, you know, each student, each school have different issues, different needs based on, you know, the people that go there determine that and work there. But at the same time, there are teachers with different needs. so it's about getting harmony and making everybody a part of the team, a team approach.
All right, thanks. Sister, make it happen.
Good evening, greetings, everyone. And so, yes, this is awesome. And following Professor Ra, that's going to be kind of challenging, but I'm going to do my best.
Well, if you have a question, that'll be good, or make a comment.
Well, I'm a school counselor by trade. And so my vision is very community oriented, and I can appreciate the efforts that have been put forth by the community schools. I see the work in two different districts. I work in one district and my children attend another district. So I can see what it looks like when it's implemented well. I can see what it looks like when it's being developed. And I can see what it looks like when it includes people like the school counselors, because we are one of those voices that don't get really heard and implemented. So I appreciate all the work that you do. And thank you. You make my heart flutter. You're beautiful and everything. I just see the future bright. And so, but yes, we got to get our table must be, as local control is where we are in the name of this game, our table has to have our families sitting there to help be part of this decision making, or then we are still not, you know, feeling left out. And so in my vision, again, I see our table empty and our decisions are being made, and it is shared decisions, but we're not at the table. So our children, again, are being left out. And so, again, it's about the efforts being made, which there are in the district. One of the districts that I'm part of, there are efforts being made, many districts, with the Black Student Achievement programs to try to include African-American parents from our cultural perspective. So we definitely are growing, and we must continue, because again, like I said, you know, on Monday, our ancestors put forth a lot to give us. And it's so awesome to hear someone like you say that you're the first one with all your rights, because to look at it like that is so powerful. So yes, you know, some of us don't understand that. And so we must continue the struggle. To God be the glory. And thank you for your time.
All right. Thanks a lot. So we're going to go to Brother Mashinda. He's not near Baton Rouge, but he's near New Orleans. Brother Mashinda.
Yeah, good evening. Yeah, I'm just taking it all in. I appreciate the presentation. Breath of fresh air, you know, down here. You know, I'm in the South right now, and, you know, been working in education for many, many years, working K through 12, worked in, you know, elementary, junior high briefly and some high school work in school suspension. And just listening to your approach and, you know, your organizational skills and things like that is much needed down here. You need to relocate, you know, back down here. Because I tell you, in some of these towns, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of students who are, you know, going without, you know, the parents, for whatever reason, in the households. You know, there's some issues, of course, and the students are the counselors and the principals. And again, I don't want to condemn everybody because you have some people with positive efforts. I appreciate your positive efforts. But, you know, in particular down here, though, in a particular school district, it's amazing that people are transferring to particular schools to increase their retirement pay. They're in their last years, and you know, it's kind of like they swap out. And I work in higher education, where, you know, dual enrollment situations, where we're trying to get a lot of the youth to get involved in dual enrollment classes. Some of the school districts pay for the student to come to the community college where I work, and then there's some like private schools actually. They pay out of pocket, the students pay out of pocket. But anyway, the point about getting the parents involved, when I ran in school suspension in one of the high schools for a little while, that was my number one thing, is to have the parent on board. And I had a few success cases, you know, kids turn around coming through in school suspension. Everybody wasn't, you know, super bad, but you had a few characters, and some didn't fare well, you know, throughout their life. But I just got excited when you were talking about, you know, the model where, you know, the community schools where you include the parent. It's given me some ideas, you know, with some things that I'm working on. But, you know, there's a lot of help needed down this way. That's all I can say. Failing schools and things like that. And like I said, we can point fingers all day and whose fault, you know, whatever. But, you know, just being able to, you know, adopt some of the things that you're saying, or just it's inspirational to hear that, you know, there's other people on the planet that are doing a lot, you know, for children in our school systems. And especially for our at-risk students, you know, the ones that, you know, that don't have the family support and things like that. But anyway, I think it's a blessing just to have you in education, have you here on the planet with us right now, just to spread what you know. And I appreciate you coming here tonight and sharing that. But again, I could talk for a little while, but I'm going to let someone else talk. You know, just and I'm all ears, and thank you for coming.
All right, thanks, brother Machinda. Okay, brother Doctor.
Yeah, I agree just with Machinda said, and Sister making it happen. And when you mentioned her name, and you said it was an article, I just kind of briefly looked up her organization, and all this other stuff started popping up. But hey, I want to commend you. I was just reading, I was going through this little deposition you did back in 2003 about the leak in San Francisco. Anyone through civil service, I'm so with civil service. And I was kind of put in as a position by the attorney general to come in and make statements. And I said, nah, I knew my position. If I go in and make a statement, go on record, I knew what my consequences were of the job. I'm going to commend you on making those statements about that leak. And, another thing, I'm looking at your website. There are a couple of questions. You said this microaggressive, Eurocentric, something you're talking about, anti-racism in classrooms. What? Give me an example of that. The microaggressive, Eurocentric. What is that? How does that work? I don't.
What's that? You're on mute, Zakiya.
I don't have a website. I don't. That I'm aware of. Are you on the CTA website?
Yeah, or? The CTA, yeah. And I saw it says something about microaggressive, Eurocentric. teaching us something about anti-racism in the classroom. I'm like, okay, well, what is that? How is that participating in class?
That's a lot.
Come on, I looked up, your name came under it. It says your stuff. So kind of training. Anti-racism in classrooms, and then how to recognize microaggressive, Eurocentric racism in classroom. What is that? How do you recognize what's going on in classrooms? I don't know about. Then it was something about dealing with the transgender. That's all new because we're in school. We didn't have that.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that? Then I saw the other thing, the Black Indigenous stuff, training. All this stuff is new to me. And I don't know if that's part of your training you do. Is that what you specialize in?
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess you could say that. Sorry. One of the roles that I play is as a trainer or a facilitator around racial and social justice concepts or content. So we have like 50 educators who are really passionate about racial and social justice, and they kind of approach their teaching from a critical pedagogy standpoint. And critical pedagogy, I mean, there's like a lot of different approaches to education. There's like traditional approaches that many of us grew up in where we're like, you just need the three R's, reading, writing, arithmetic, right? But then there's also like existential pedagogy where kind of like our Montessori school where it's like, oh, allow kids to discover. So it's about like 8 or 9 pedagogical approaches to teaching. Critical pedagogy is another approach. And that is an approach where you look at historical patterns, you look at systemic issues of oppression or the ways in which the different isms play out in systems. And it involves a deep sense of self-reflection. And so so many of our trainings and our educators have that critical pedagogy approach. And it's about like having honesty in education, being able to talk about issues of race and gender, where inequities historically have happened systemically, where we see like these inequitable outcomes continue to happen. And so we try to, we have educators that's their training. And so then they work with other educators to like help raise awareness around a multitude of issues. So we might look at microaggressions. We may look at the characteristics of white supremacy culture. They may look at ways to be less, to have a classroom with the equity lens so that we're aware of the ways in which we maybe operate that actually push kids further away from like having joy in learning. And some of those are like practices that we've inherited. Some of them are just like parts of the culture that we have internalized. As an example, might be like this sense of urgency is one of those characteristics. And you see this in the classroom a lot, especially during testing during the focus around No Child Left Behind during the Bush era. And it was like, you know, there's this constant sense of urgency. I felt it. I had to cover this curriculum. I had to get through these lessons because the test is in April. And it wasn't about like if the kids actually absorbed it. Was there experiential learning? Were we doing relevant like project-based learning where that takes time, but it's not necessarily in a book? So this like value around trying to be urgent with everything is one of these characteristics that Tima Okul identifies as characteristics of white supremacy culture. And so within some of those cultural practices, we try to like lift that up for educators to see the ways that our like dominant cultural practices can actually kind of cause harm to our students. And so we try to like use that to, we call it decolonizing our mind. It's sort of the colonizer's approach. It's like urgent, you know, we want it in writing. If you can't read it, then we're gonna take it from you. And so we've got this worship of the written word, which is another characteristic. So anyway, we just try to like help raise educators' awareness about the ways in which that we went through school. And because we were successful getting through school, obviously because we made it to become a teacher, so we went and got our degree and all that, successful, you know, relatively speaking, we still end up like perpetuating the same kind of oppressive behaviors that maybe we experienced. And so we try to like help teachers see that and so that they can be more conscious of when it's necessary to be like urgent and when there's times where, you know, actually it's okay. We're going to This is a good question. This experiment is giving us like something to really think about. Let's just take the time and explore this further. Let's ask some questions around. Let's let the kids talk some more instead of just like kind of trying to get a worksheet done. So those
now,
are
now, is that, wait. Now is that now? Are you talking teachers, non-Black teachers, or is this all teachers in general? Is it kind of more towards the white teachers that kind of bring their culture in and kind of. Is that what you're, basically you're talking about them, or I don't know if that's
no, educators
talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's educators as a whole. We're the statewide union and there's about 350,000 members that are part of our union. They all work in the various districts, about 1,000 districts. And it's like 1,080 districts that are public school districts that are unionized. And so those teachers will request trainings at their school because they want to make their school, they want to improve their own practices. And especially if they're seeing things like, you know, they have 2% population of Black students, but they're like, when you look at the suspensions, 50% of the suspensions are the Black students. It's like, but they're only 2%. How is that happening? What's going on? And so that's where we can come and help, where people will ask for trainings around like, why is that, you know, what do we need to do to fix that? And some of it is like your own internalized bias that you have around Black and Brown students because of the way in which historically we've been conditioned to see Black and Brown students as sort of like in a different caste within our like hierarchy in the U.S. And so we just try to like help teachers raise that awareness so that they can understand some of the historical implications as to why we may have those biases, how they've been reinforced over time, and they end up manifesting in different policies that get put out or voting issues that get vote supported or not supported. And also just like in our teaching practice and how we might discipline or how we might have lower tolerance for certain behaviors from students who we already have assigned or believe are, you know, not us or who we already believe are have some internal bias against because of our conditioning and not really exploring or challenging our biases. So we know that those inequitable outcomes happen where kids are disproportionately suspended or they're over disciplined, especially Black and Brown kids. There's plenty of research that shows like teachers, even their gaze, they'll look at in a preschool, they'll correct a Black student, particularly Black boys, for the same behaviors that that another student who's not Black is doing. Like there's like a lower tolerance for certain behaviors that our students end up getting penalized more heavily for. And so we're trying to like help raise that awareness, help teachers explore their biases, what kind of ways that they by default just kind of have these mindsets and that we have that end up impacting our behaviors in our discipline and in our tone and how we'll, you know, greet students or express our frustration. Oftentimes our BIPOC students are, like I said, they're just given less leeway to make the same mistakes that other kids do. And so we try to, you know, work with educators with like evolving some of that thinking and learning some of that. And so we'll offer these different kind of trainings that the educators have said, like, we need to know more about this so we can help our colleagues not be so, you know, partial or biased or punitive, overly punitive.
Okay, well, again, thanks. Like I said, you know, when I said you have an article back way, way back then where, you know, you're getting a pay cut and you were buying school supplies on your own, you'd spend all those times, interviewed your husband, and he's telling the life of being married to a teacher, and you're there all day on your own time with the 15% pay cut and buying supplies and giving all your students your parents your phone number. I read all that too real quick. So, hey, you're dedicated. Yeah, I mean, yeah, hey, I'm proud of you. I'm proud of the work you did, you're doing, did. Have done, going to do in the future, and you're helping everyone out, and hopefully, I usually come on this show and say nothing's going to change, but if the world was working around your your ideals and your work ethic, stuff would change. So, but hey, I'm glad you came on the show tonight. Thank you.
That's amazing. You got Brother Doctor to change his tone. That is amazing. Okay, excellent.
Thanks, being right now. Thank you for saying that.
My goodness. That's hope. First.
That sounds like hope. It's hard to have hope in these days and times. Oh, so.
Okay, Brother Hembrick. That's a good one.
Evening, sister. Appreciate your presentation.
How you doing, Brother Henry? Thank you.
I'm a long-time educator, been retired 7 years. I was a truth teacher. I didn't teach his story. I taught the truth.
Yes. Yes.
A lot. But I got my first question before I get to the other questions I have. When you were at Hillcrest, did you have the pleasure to work under Principal Ed Brownlee?
Oh, yes.
Sounds like it. That was my boy. That's my homeboy.
Yes.
Yeah, matter of fact, he was on the basketball team with Professor Ra when they were in high school. But Ed is my boy from way back. What? I got to check on his wife. Yeah, we played junior college football together, and he went to Loyola Marymount, and then I followed him after I left UCLA. But they had a great history department.
That's where I went to. I graduated from LMU.
Oh, okay.
I knew Mr. Brownlee. He was like my biggest ally, in fact, when I came to Inglewood, and I was president of the union by that time. I went to Hillcrest. And he was just always supportive. He was just encouraging. He supported us, our collaboration, our attempts to kind of do school differently at the continuation school. He was always about the kids.
From the way you were talking, I knew you had to be under him some kind of way, because that's how he was all the time.
Yep.
Anyway, getting to my questions, it seems like this community school thing you talked about is what a WASS accreditation is supposed to be anyway, if they write and not do the dog and pony show like
that. Right. Yep.
Because everyone should be involved in collaborating what the kids' education going to be. The kids, the parents, community members, counselors, everybody. And it's rare that they do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Comment. And I was really moved by you going outside the box with the laundry thing. That was great. That's something. And then another thing I want to bring up, since I'm talking about that, most of these schools, you know, the showers don't work. If they do work, they don't have no hot water. That's another thing. A student may, school may be the only place they have to take a shower. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Through Compton, which is where I worked most of my career, I don't think they have hot water in a locker room nowhere in the district, which is pathetic.
Yeah, I just...
My next comment is about the, as a teacher, you kind of got to be like a doctor, you know, diagnosing a patient if you really care about them.
Yeah.
See what's up with them, where they need to improve, and then devise a program to bring them up from where they are. Yeah. And teachers aren't willing to do that.
Yeah.
When I was an administrator and I hated it, I should have stayed in the classroom longer so I could have turned out more soldiers. But, you know, the first thing I used to do the first day is check their reading ability.
Yeah.
Which lets you know, how you got to do your lesson planning and whatnot and get snuck, which a lot of teachers, they go the whole year and don't check the kids. And then they wonder why the kid is a discipline problem in the classroom, because he can't read, especially if you're a teacher like, read these pages and answer these questions, but a kid can't read, what's he going to do?
They going to do, yep.
And I love that program that Ed had with this other brother, where they had these little devices where the kids could get up to the level in reading and math. And and they had to show certain mastery before we let them go. But these little handheld devices.
Yeah.
His name that Ed was working with. You probably know what I'm talking about.
I remember them. I can't think of the name of the company, but I do remember.
Yeah, I was trying to get that centennial, but the principal kind of was reluctant.
What
I want to talk about is the union stuff. I know unions are necessary. And in my experiences during my career, most of the teachers who were lousy were the union reps. And as an administrator, you know, you got to kind of document and try to help them. And, and they would always hide up under the union banner. And then, you know, they would raise enough cane to where, you know, you got transferred before you had the opportunity to, you know, to complete the clinical observation of them and try to help them out, which most of them don't want to improve anyway. They want to stick to what they're doing. What else I got here? Yeah, we had a safe passage program in Compton where we worked. We had a grant from the state with the probation department and the sheriff's, and we would monitor the you know, the travel routes for kids on the way to school and the way home from school. We had it coordinated with the buses, kids that had to catch the bus. We had their, you know, we had them involved also.
That's awesome.
What else I got here? Yeah, and I want to mention this too, a book a brother told me about years ago when I first got into administration. It was called Beyond the Bake Sale.
Okay, I like this.
Yeah, it was about, you know, getting the parents involved in all the aspects of their child's, you know, education. And it's great that you guys were asking the parents, you know, what do they need, you know, to help their kid out? Because, you know, in his old book, Johnny can't read, well, because the parent couldn't read either.
Yeah.
Get them both involved in the reading program, you know, so they could help their kid out.
Yeah, it's taking a different approach. It's one of my mentors taught me how, especially at Hillcrest, at the alternative school, this approach worked, was really important, which was, you know, we tend to look at students and their misbehavior or something, and we'll be like, what's wrong with you? You know, and he's like, we shouldn't be asking what's wrong with you. We should be asking what happened to you.
Right. Exactly.
And understanding that gets us asking, well, why are they doing this? Ask a couple of whys, get to that root cause. And that's what you got, you know, what you're, I think you're lifting up is like, that's what you're addressing. You're like, I don't have to see if they know how to read. I know I don't have to do that. I can give them the curriculum and good luck. I'm getting my check. Right. But, you know, we can also take the approach of like, I'm trying to understand what is in the way because I believe in you. I see you. I know you can, I know you're capable. I know you are a human being here. You know, the creator put you here for a purpose. And so what, your skills aren't there, then I'm gonna try to help get your skills right, or I'm gonna help bring material so that you can access it to still engage in this like higher level conversation. And I think that's, you know, that's very commendable. And that's like what we should be doing as educators. I know there's always, you know, there's always folks that don't want to change, or some human tendency to resist change and all those. And I know that exists. But there's more of us, more people like us who are like, what happened to you? You know, and then take it from that approach as opposed to seeing them as the problem. I mean, they still are youth. They're still our youth, you know, they're still kids to some, you know, young adults.
And this is that.
Really, okay. Professor Rob been raising his hand for the longest, so.
Yeah, this chicken. I guess this is one more thing in, brother. That he
yeah, Rob wanted to get some in.
And let me say that compounds it even more, the fact that the kids are in the system, especially the kids.
Yeah.
They're in the foster care group home. And it's rare that you can get, you know, those parents, you know, because they just want that check.
Yeah.
I'm going to defer to the elder and let him take it from here. But It was a pleasure speaking to you.
Likewise.
To you. Get Thank back you. To the classroom and help them kids.
All right. I'm trying to be like you and get more soldiers, you know, in a better position. So.
Well, the teachers is tough, you know. And I used to tell them in staff meetings when I was administrator, if we had to grow up like these kids have to grow up, many of us wouldn't be here. And I would play the cut from Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, wake up everybody.
Yes.
I play that for a staff meeting, you know. But anyway, it was a pleasure talking to you. And I could tell that you was an Ed Brownlee disciple. I could tell that as soon as you got to talk.
Oh, rest in peace, Mr. Brownlee. You see that?
You know, he passed a few years back.
Yes. Yeah. So I said, rest in peace. I know he's smiling. Thank you for saying that. And love Mr.
And you're a Loyola grad on top of that. That's great. As a matter of fact, my daughter went there also.
Yep, my daughter too.
What?
We have a Loyola Marymount grad too.
That's I love it. It was
and her name is Ma'at.
Ma'at? Yeah. I graduated in what year was it? 97? I graduated in 97, so probably way before them, after them.
She's in medical school now.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Brother Hembrick.
Thank you.
Professor Rye?
Yeah, appreciate what's been said, if I understand correctly. And as Joe said, and historian Joe spoke at Mr. Brownlee's service, had comment. I grew up with him. I didn't just go to school with him and didn't just work with him. We lived on 126th Street in Mona. And we went to Centennial together, high school buddies. I mean, we weren't just people that knew each other. We hung out. We went to parties together, dances. And, you know, we was in a little gang called the Condors. And, you know, so we really grew up together. And I went to his school in Englewood.
Yeah.
He came up under the tutelage of Mr. Freeman at Willowbrook.
Oh.
Yeah, Mr. Lawrence Freeman, who went over to Englewood and Englewood High School and then so on. Then when Mr. Freeman retired, Brownlee became a principal over there at the alternative
school. Okay. I came after Mr. Freeman was the superintendent, but I heard about Mr. Freeman, but I never worked under him. But by the time I got there, I heard about him.
He used to shut school down at 12 noon and everybody had to read for an hour during the lunch period.
Mm-hmm.
But I just have a few things. When you say you, the schools have changed. And a lot of people complain about school doing so much. They feed, they deal with health issues, they deal with a multitude of safety, just you know, free lunches, all that stuff, nurses, inoculations, making sure kids are inoculated, required. Schools are compulsory for the most part.
Yeah.
Sometimes it takes from kindergarten or even Head Start to the 12th grade, that's 12 years. We used to say it don't take 12 years to teach nobody nothing, you know, I mean, for as they grow. But my question is, do you feel that schools are doing too much for the services? So you want community involvement, but then at the same time, many people complain that the school do too much, and that's why they can't focus on education and the teachers, like you say, like Ms. Henry said, some of you teachers come out your pocket to give people lunch money, come out your, or either go home for them to go home and have snack. You work with them to get along, especially the student leaders. But you know, what's your feeling on that? And how many students are in the classroom?
Mm-hmm.
That's a major issue with the union.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, well, I'm going to back out a little bit because I think schools get put in a position to solve so many problems or issues. And I don't think that's a fair space. Like, I think our schools are like a microcosm of our community. And I think it serves, like those in power, that, that top 1%, 2%. I think it serves them for people to think that our problems can actually be solved in schools. And then those same people support the underfunding, the under-resourcing of our schools. And then they blame our schools for not like providing the resources to support change they need, when a lot of the problems we have in school, they do stem, the root causes of those things don't get actually addressed or dealt with. So that's one piece, is like, I don't think it's fair that actually schools are seen as like put on this responsibility to try to fix these ills when they're underfunded. There's a concerted effort to defund public schools and the opportunity to provide. That all being so knowing that they're under-resourced and underserved, I support like the need to support the whole child. And so I think we should have robust art and extra, learning opportunities and extra duty, extracurricular stuff for students after school. And that can be childcare for families. And I support like, if in a certain community, needing to coordinate how students get to school safely, that in that area, that's something that they need to do. I support that they should be able to do that, because that's what they know what students need in order to be safe to come to school. So I believe in like educating the whole child, in that that our schools should be spaces for our students who are great at textbook, but also should be spaces for our students who are good with their hands and want to do more practical application of things. And the fact that we, over time, not we, but collectively policymakers, decision makers have like cut down the funding, that means that we have to kind of have those.
When you go out to Hollywood schools, UC Irvine,
yeah,
sometimes down to Laguna, they have open campus.
Yep.
Students can leave and go. We got schools that look like Lompoc Penitentiary.
Yep.
Gates all around them. And then second, like they're in cages.
Yep.
The other thing is that you have a situation where, as in those schools, students make movies. Students have more equipment, vocational.
Yep. They deal
not just auto mechanics and some little mediocre type of thing, but they really get into electronics, computer technology, and they even have it where they learn video games.
Yeah.
But when we come to our schools in the urban areas and in Black communities and Latino communities, the focus is discipline.
Yep.
And so my question to you is that, as Joe would say, the unions, they protect bad teachers, alcoholic teachers, the teachers that have a high absentee, and they defend teachers. Is that correct? I mean, the primary purpose of a union is to look out for the teacher, but they've never, I've been in education all my life. Since 1970, I started teaching. I started teaching before that on street corners and stuff, but the community. But I'm just saying that you have a dilemma when, as historian Joe was saying, when you don't see teachers really fighting for the conditions that these schools have turned into dilapidated situation, where they don't have air conditioning or heaters, or where they don't have, you very seldom see a union You know, well, there's some that say you're going to go on strike unless you change the condition. But, you know, that's a whole new different ball game. You know, they use that to really try to leverage more money, more salaries. And the high rate of absentees of teachers and substitutes, what do you think about that?
Well, I think a couple of things. I mean, unions, we know that they have a history of having adopted same attitudes, right? Historically, they were racist, they were exclusionary. When folks were migrating from the South to the North, unions would not allow Black folks to come into the union. So I know that we have a complex history. But actually the purpose of union is the scope of the union, according to our collective bargaining rights, is like the role of the union is to advocate for salary, benefits, and working conditions. It's not to defend. What we do enforce is due process. And there's a reason why we have due process rights and a right to like just fair disciplining, because teaching is a political act. We're either teaching the history, the status quo, or we are expanding it. And we need protections around that because we know that historically people in power don't want to share it. And in order for us to make change and be able, it's like we have to be able to provide people with information and truth and honesty and education. And I think we need protections around that. So I didn't see my job in the union as defending a teacher. What I did see was myself in defending a process. And my dad taught me that, he always taught me, because I would have this dilemma all the time, which is also when I was, as a teacher, I always tried to be like the best that I could be. I wanted to make sure I was a good representative of our teachers' union. And I also wanted to model how to be principled in our approach. So my dad taught me that, you know, like when I have an issue or I don't agree with someone, my job is not to defend. I'm not a defense attorney. In the union, we're not defense attorneys. We defend process. So I'm going to ensure that that person has due process. And if I don't agree, they got to have due process. But if you're right, like I am going to fight for you. If I think the facts around the situation, then I'm going to. Let me give you
that. There have been teachers that have been accused of molesting or even having inappropriate relationships with students. And unions turn their back to it. And unions don't say nothing when they transfer them to another school instead of firing them. Are either taking a position, but when charges come up, they defend them and they negotiate, well, just transfer them out of that situation. That didn't happen. And then, you know, you hear that in the news a lot, but you can get to that question after you also say you deal with human rights, human and social justice as a union rep. Is that right? Yeah, you were dealing with human rights and social justice for teachers. Was that your position in the union?
But currently that's my position. Job title. Yes.
Yeah. Now, did they require you to get special training in that, or was that just what they asked you to do?
Did I get special training for this job? No, I think my role in as a teacher, the way I approached my own pedagogy, I think through my union experience, the lens that I brought, like made them select me for this position, but, I didn't have any specific training to be in this position. I just happened to have that kind of like background knowledge, and then, you know, learn more about other concepts. Like, I wasn't very versed in a lot of LGBTQ plus issues as an example. But that is an area that our members and want to know more about and be able to support students and that kind of nature. So then I, you know, have to learn more about that, work with other folks from that community so that I can better support educators to be responsive to that.
Do you think that they should have armed guards on campuses, armed police?
I'm really conflicted around that. I don't think so. When I worked in LA or UTLA, the example you gave of like how some schools are like prisons. I mean, I worked in the West area, so I had schools from Arlington all the way to the beach area. So I had like Crenshaw, Dorsey, but then I also had like Palisades, and just driving from one end of town to the other town was just always enraging to me because the conditions on the West side, at schools where students were treated with trust, where they had open campus, where they weren't having random searches, being treated like criminals. It was just like a different vibe and energy, and you could feel that. And that's a lot of the things that students were saying at Dorsey and at Crenshaw as they were advocating for like removing police on campus in favor of having more counselors or having more like resource type folks on campus. So I don't think there's any data that shows having an armed guard actually saves anything. So I don't support that.
Well, I think they need to be managed better, but in certain schools, they better have some armed guards. I mean, teachers get assaulted as well as people come to campus with guns. Students have them if you don't have nobody to check them. You know, they have grievances. But anyway, that's just my... The other issue is, you know, the attendance issue with virtual learning. Mm. How are the teachers and the unions treating that? Because there's a lot of complaints about students are far behind because they went to virtual learning during COVID, and they still letting some students opt out to virtual learning. Mm. And they saying that sometimes the Wi-Fi don't work, the computer don't work, and the teacher is giving too much for students to do in virtual education that they wouldn't even be getting if they was in regular school.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that there's some that are continuing the practice. I mean, I don't think it's ideal, although virtual learning, the research shows that it works well for certain students, but the pandemic kind of made us all have to go into virtual learning and learn how to, and even learn that pedagogical approach as educators. We were expected to like change overnight from being in hard buildings to hardwired. I think it does work. I mean, research says it works for some students, more specifically students that are independent, who are at level and can kind of manage their own load. It's not for everyone. So I don't, you know, I understand that schools are still offering it because many parents are opting out of coming back on campus still. It's less now than it was like last year. So I understand that many districts that still kept an online option was because parents were the ones asking for that option. Although that maybe they wasn't the best option for their student. And then about the whole virtual learning with the pandemic. I mean,
my last question is, the first school teachers didn't have credentials. Teachers weren't required to have credentials, the first teachers, especially in private school, that nuns did the teaching. Wow. You know, and things of this nature. In California, it has one of the most rigorous credentialing programs. You go to other states, it's not as rigorous. Some states, you know, they don't even require credentials. But California do. Then they complain that they don't have they took away the life credential. You know, they used to give up if you taught.
Right.
And that was an incentive for people to go to work as a teacher because it offered security. So they got rid of that. Now, but the process of getting a credential, sometimes it takes students 2 and 3 years to get their credential. And then sometimes they have to, it's hard for them to pass the test for renewal and for, you know, just to get the first one. So what are the unions doing? You say you don't have enough teachers. And then when they hire, and you don't want them to hire people that don't have credentials who probably be a better teacher than the one with the credential. But the point is that, I mean, what's the union's position? I've never heard them say that, hey, we need to, you know, quit putting teachers through all of this and then don't pay them worth of nothing. And then have bad work conditions. But you want them to have all these credentials when some people can teach. Our mothers didn't get a credential to raise us. So, I mean, what's going on here?
Well, I think it's important to know, like, who makes those decisions. Do you think it's the students that are coming out of education programs or the teachers that want to go into teaching or even the union who's always advocating for having qualified, and attractive salaries for teachers that make that rule?
I think it's about attrition and about trying to get teachers' salary higher in the state of California. Because you have local union, then you have state union,
mm-hmm.
CTC, whatever you, and just like doctors, you know, they make you go 10 years in an internship, you know, so you don't have an abundance, employment control, unions calculate these things, how many teachers they have, how many teachers people need in different areas. And they try to control it from that standpoint. They don't want people infringing. You wouldn't got your credential. You wouldn't want nobody making the same money you make it. And they didn't get a credential, even though they may be more effective as far as coming up in the community, knowing the students don't have a discipline problem, don't get high absentee, but they can't get a job. But the teacher with the job, you know, within the first semester, they didn't use all their absentee up and substitute up, but they'll use some of their salary to hire another substitute to go in. You know, how did that? That's one thing I'm saying. Have you ever seen that problem?
Currently in a shortage and entering into a teacher shortage. So yes, I have seen that problem, seen it also in the beginning of my teaching years. In fact, that's how I started teaching, because it was a teaching shortage. And so they just made it very easy. We just had to get an emergency credential, take some courses. And that's when I started teaching. But I would, you know, I'd ask the question, like, should we have standards and sort of some standards and expectations for educators who are going to be in front of, you know, students? I mean, if we respect professions that are more male dominated, like engineers, doctors, you know, you just mentioned, if in those professions, it's okay to have strict licensing and respect for the art and the skill that's required to do that job. You know, I often wonder why people don't have that same or hold that same type of expectation, or why would they question the education profession also having high standards and expecting high pay. And I think some of that is connected to the fact that the profession is a majority women, female profession, and that some people don't value or actually see that teaching is a skill. It's a science. There's an art and a science to teaching that we are learning over time. So yes, our parents are first teachers and they do help equip us in all of those things, but there's also like an expertise that we are being able to provide that folks that help like elevate our profession, that help elevate women into careers, into, you know, having like a decent salary, living wages, and being able to have a decent retirement.
So sometimes when people question like that, I often wonder why don't they question, you know, the expectations for someone to become certified as a doctor, or why that's not an issue. And why aren't we talking about that doctor's union or even the police's union? Teachers don't, I like the union. We don't hire people. The district, the superintendent, the board, they hire the folks. Once they hire them, then they become members or not with us. And then we try and build with them. But some of those decisions are partly why we have a union, because those credentialing measures or those decisions are made by politicians, the CDE, State Board of Ed, and we need to be able to make sure we're at the table, you know? And so that's part of our role or goal in being the union is like, these people are going to be making decisions about what kind of credential, what the requirements are, making them too harsh that we can't get people in. So we want to make sure that we're at the table. Our unions do much more than just defend. I think that's one of the roles we have and responsibilities. We have a duty of fair representation, but our unions also fight to have seats at the table where people are making decisions that will impact our students, impact the educators working in those buildings too. It's multiple. It's both and, I think.
I have a quick comment, if I can make it, on that subject right there, if I could, Rasha Keith.
Yeah, and then we're gonna close out. Go ahead.
This is what I've told human resources. When you're hiring a teacher, have them come prepared to teach a lesson in the interview. Mm-hmm. Asking some questions, you know, because people can master the question thing. But you get up there and teach a lesson, just like when I would hire coaches. You have to go to the chalkboard and show me something that you know what you're talking about. And they should mm-hmm. do the same thing with teachers. You come prepared to teach a lesson, then you find out if they can teach right away. Instead of hiring them, 6 months later, you find out they ain't worth nothing. Then you got to do all the documentation to get rid of them. And by the time you get started on the documentation, you know, they done transferred you. So the next person to come in got to start all over again. And I say most of, and as far as administrators go, you can't evaluate good instruction if you never provided it yourself. Just like hiring a GM on a ball club. If he never played the sport, then how the hell are they going to know?
Yeah.
And so I'm going to end my conversation with that. Appreciate you, sister.
Yeah, okay. No, really good dialogue. I appreciate that.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of good things said. This was very, very good. And I think we're going to have a part two because I still have a few more questions I didn't get to. But this is good to go around the panel and have more of a discussion and have the panel ask questions. So this was excellent and excellent job. I mean,
thank you.
I mean, if you can inspire Brother Doctor, that's rare.
I bear witness.
I appreciate you coming, and I want to have you back.
Okay, I would love to. I'm going to be watching the channel. I'm going to come and check y'all out. I appreciate the invitation and just the stimulating conversation. It's so complex, so many different angles. And, you know, I learned things in the space just from your questions. I just appreciate, I'm humbled that you asked me to, you know, come join. So I'll do it anytime.
Well, it was a good thing we did ask you. Well, I did. And I'm pretty sure everybody else agreed with that. And
fine.
So many thanks. So next week, Professor Rod, you have anybody for next week? I think you do.
Yeah, well, brother, historian Joe contacted Anthony Samad, one of the most premier educators. He's the director of the Murray Timely Political Institute at Cal State Dominion. He's a former president of NAACP. He's author and associate professor, and he will be here to discuss The Ballot or the Bullet, 20, the aftermath of the 2022 election, giving us an analysis of where it affecting the situation with Black people.
Excellent, excellent. Aisha.
Yes.
Yeah, I just want to say this is open to the public, so you could join anytime. We're here on Mondays and Wednesdays.
Okay.
So, yeah, and you just join the same way you joined in today
on the homepage. Okay. And going into the Zoom link.
Yes.
All right.
And so next week, the guest for this show, we have Ross Kasim Mascani. That's my grandson, a 9-year-old. We're going to have a 9-year-old on next week. I'm going to interview him.
That's awesome.
So that should be a treat. Yeah.
Yeah.
So excellent, excellent. So well, I'm going to just say what I normally say. Each one teach one in Conscious Corner. Everybody have a good evening.
All right.